the alcoholic.
Amen.
And God's doing for me today what I couldn't do for myself, because it's like 12:15 in Reykjavik, and I haven't had anything to drink all day. Now, being in Reykjavik, you think that you should be able to drink just a little bit, right? Just a little bit. I bring you greetings from your brothers and sisters in the South Bay of Los Angeles who are doing the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in the very same way that you are doing it here. And know that our love is with you, as it is everywhere in the world where men and women are getting together for the purpose of not drinking. Now, you know, it's funny that a guy like me would end up in a place like this, but then again, I am enthusiastic about Alcoholics Anonymous. I love Alcoholics Anonymous because Alcoholics Anonymous has saved my life. I come to you from a family, because we're all Foo Fighters here, family of origin fighters. And I come from a family, my alcohol killed my stepmother, Marcia. Cirrhosis of the liver. It killed my brother-in-law, Douglas. Cirrhosis of the liver. My father died of esophageal cancer, but he was far, far gone in his alcoholism. I have a sister, Regina, who sends her love. She's sober 20 years. Her husband, Greg, is sober 22 years. I have an ex-wife who's celebrating 22 years of sobriety this week. I have my fabulous wife, Adele, who's sober 17 years. And I came to you on the second day of May in 1979. And although I found it necessary a lot of times, I haven't taken the front drink. I haven't smoked any of that non-habit-forming marijuana. I haven't done any of that Peruvian marching powder. I haven't done any of that glue that I found to be so consoling. And all these people that I mentioned to you have all been sober from their first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. So if you're new and with us, I want you to know that you don't ever have to drink ever again, one day at a time. And if a day is too long, an hour at a time. And if an hour is too long, a minute at a time. And if a minute's too long, a moment at a time. It's possible not to take the front drink, because it's only in this moment that we stay sober. It's not in tomorrow, and I always thought it was in tomorrow. So I come from this family, and I mean, if you go back through my grandparents, my cousins, all these kids that I was the oldest of my mother's and her sister's. I'm the oldest of all the kids. So I'm the one that turned them all onto drugs. And they are, there's only one, and he's a very strange man. There's only one that isn't a drug addict, that isn't a ward of the state, either inside or outside of prison. I have another sister, though, Maria, who is not in that category. Maria is one of those women who dates poorly and marries worse. My mother's been in the Al-Anon family groups for 23 years. So if there are any people here who are members of the family groups, I want to thank you for what it is that you've done in our lives. Al-Anon is really, really important. In fact, Bill's father taught us a lot about Al-Anon, because he was sober in the meetings. Bill's mother actually was one of the founders. I'm talking about Bill Cleveland, not Bill Wilson. if this is an unaligned tape, you know, if you're listening to this solo. It's not part of the box set. Bill C's mother was one of the founders of the Los Angeles Al-Anon Central Office. And Gordon and Gordon and Priscilla went around and they caused a big stir in Alcoholics Anonymous in the Los Angeles and Southern California and really even nationally, because they would go and speak at things like this. Gordon would get invited because he was sober a long time, and he would get his wife up and they would share the time together, because they felt that firmly that alcoholism is a family disease. And Gordon taught us that the Al-Anon family groups are more important than Alcoholics Anonymous. Because in Al-Anon, an entire family can get well. In Alcoholics Anonymous, it's only the drunk. So those of you who are involved in Al-Anon, God bless you. And if you haven't had a privilege of getting involved and being and listening to the Al-Anon stories, they're frightening. As they were in my house, because my mother was the violent one. She's not the reason I'm alcoholic. I was born in the city of El Segundo, California, which is this little piece of Oklahoma that's been transported to the coast of California. And on one side is the Los Angeles International Airport. And on the other side is the Northrop Defense Contractor. And on the south side of the town is a huge oil refinery. It's the second oil refinery in the state of California. It's where the town got its name, El Segundo II. And then on the little patch of beach in between the town and the Pacific Ocean is the waste treatment plant for the entire county of Los Angeles. All the crap goes through El Segundo. So getting toxic is just a way of life. You know, you just want to be right with your environment. And so I'm born into this family, and I was very, very blessed. My family, for all their weirdness, gave me the gift of reading. And then they gave me the gift of, they taught me good manners. And they made sure that I went to school and that I got my homework done. And they introduced me to God as they understood God. And for all the weirdness that happened in my life, the truth is that they gave me the ability that no matter how far down the ladder I went, I had the tools to climb back up. And for that, I am always grateful. Now, this family that I have, they did not make me alcoholic, although I believe that I am a poster child, that there is some kind of genetic component to this disease that I have, alcoholism, which is a chronic, fatal, progressive illness. And I didn't know it. You remember the short guy in school? I was the short kid. I can't throw the ball as far. I can't run as fast. I'm not as tough. But by the time I'm 12 years old, I find something that I can do better than kids that are bigger, and faster, and stronger than me. And that's drink alcohol. This is obviously a gift from God. And I don't know that what it is that I have a physical allergy to beverage alcohol, that when I put it in me, it does something to me that it doesn't do to 90% of the population. Example, when I start to drink, you get fascinating. When I start to drink for the first time, I can use my whole lung capacity. All the knots of self-obsession unwound out of the back of my neck and my shoulders when I started to drink. And I thought this happened with everybody, but that's not the case. It only happens with these allergic types, people that are allergic to beverage alcohol.
the alcoholics. So I got this way of when I drink, things get wonderful. And the other way that this disease that I have, this alcoholism, this chronic, fatal, progressive illness manifests is that all kinds of things work differently in me. By the time I'm 16 years old, my idea of a good time is to take a rack of Reds, a high-powered sedative, a barbiturate, eat it, and then follow it with a quart of Spignata wine. In 90% of the population, when they do this, what happens, they call it synergistic effect. The barbiturates and the alcohol mix up in the brain, and the body actually many times forgets how to breathe. And people throw up and they choke on their vomit and they die. With me, I'm looking for car keys and to make short-term romantic commitments. If you're wondering whether you're alcoholic or not, take a look at what it is you do for fun and then see what that behavior does to most other people. Another example of this disease that I have, this alcoholism, this chronic fatal malady, blackouts. If you have woken up with a life form with which you were unfamiliar when you left the house in the morning, you may want to look at your relationship to alcohol. A blackout, I define as operating my body with no knowledge of what's going on. You know, and I woke up with all kinds of things. You know, I was fortunate that it was the 70s. It wasn't that I was homosexual. There were just a few guys around. Wasn't a lifestyle or anything. It's not like it was a choice. It was just what I did. So, I've got this chronic fatal malady, and I don't know what it is. The other thing about this disease that I have, this alcoholism, is what's called the phenomenon of craving. It's so pronounced. It has been with the human beings for so long that the Chinese have a proverb about it. The man takes a drink, and then the drink takes a drink, and then the drink takes the man. And I don't know what that is. I think that what it is that I'm just an enthusiastic young man that loves to have a good time and hates to be around a bunch of lames. I don't realize that I have alcoholism. And the way did this ever happen to you? You come home and they've changed the locks. And so you knock on the door and then you look and you see that they have the alcoholic luggage waiting for you. Two trash bags with all your worldly belongings stuffed into them. And so what do? You know, you bang on the door. And finally they open it after you've woken up the neighbors, right? And they stand there and they're crying and they look at you and they go, "What are you doing here?" I said, "Well, I said I'd be home at 4 o'clock. That was Tuesday afternoon. This is Thursday morning. Where have you been?" "Well, I've been busy." "Doing what?" And it wasn't until I came to you, it wasn't until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that I found out what the problem was, that I was alcoholic, that I took the front drink. I don't know about you guys, but I hate to pay retail. So my idea of a good career path is to tend bar, preferably during the day, so that I'm available for the evening's activities. And what happened is I got off work, right? And I went and I had a couple of drinks with the boys. And then we went to an all-night place. And then we got up in the morning, or we didn't get up. We went and we opened a bar at 6 o'clock and we pushed some food around on the plate. And then we got some money and then we went and got some of that non-addictive cocaine so we could be awake long enough to drink all through the next day and
through the next night, and I'm done and I'm home. You were supposed to be home at 4 o'clock because we were going to go out with my mother. Well, I didn't remember. No, it's not good enough. See, once I take the front drink, I cannot predict what's going to happen to me. Now, does this happen every time? No. But it happens often enough that this other part of this disease that I have, this alcoholism, this chronic fatal malady, is that that's really good. This chronic fatal malady is that I can't be assured that I'm going to be anyplace. And so the soul sickness starts to manifest. And I violate the trust of anybody that put any in me, and I don't know why that is. I think that what I am is I'm a bad guy getting what I deserve. Did you ever have this happen to you? They look at you and they go, no drinking at work. Well, okay, I won't have anything to drink at work. And no drinking before you come to work either. Well, really? Okay. So I'd get off work and I'd go out and I'd have a few drinks, right? And I'd get home early. Now, in the United States, where the bars close at 2 a.m., early is defined as if I'm home at 1:45 a.m., I'm home early, right? I'm home before they kick me out. And then in those days, I had good sponsorship. I go and I lay down, and I know that because I've been waking up in the middle of the night, I've been taught to keep a beer iced next to the bed. So what I can do is when I pop up, I can drink it down and go back down for another couple hours. And then I get up at 6 o'clock in the morning and I start getting ready to go to work. And I have a few beers. And then I go and I get on the bus, right? And you guys all know why I'm riding the bus. Because I can't get another driving under the influence. I can't pay another lawyer. I can't go back to jail again. I don't want to do that, so I'm taking the bus. And where am I taking the bus? I'm taking the bus downtown because that's where the low-class bars are, the only kind of bars that are going to hire a guy like me. And I have another beer or two on the way in. And I walk in, ready to go to work, and my tongue is just a little thick. And they go, what the hell is wrong with you? Didn't we just talk about this yesterday? You told us you weren't going to drink anything before you came to work. And I say, well, I haven't been drinking with all the sincerity in my heart. Because I know, like you know, that beer's not drinking. It's a food, right? At the very least, it's a beverage. But my alcoholic life was the only one that seemed normal to me. I have no connection to reality. And I don't know what's wrong with me. I just think I'm a bad guy. You know, when they look at you and they're crying the tears and they say, you don't love me. You'd rather be drinking with your friends. No, I love you. But I don't realize that when I take the first drink, I can't predict where it is that I'm going to end up. I'm alcoholic. I have a chronic, fatal, progressive illness. And it gets me to the point that I'm living in my car. You know? And I wasn't homeless in those days. It was just my outdoorsman phase. You know, just me being one with nature. What happened is I got arrested one more time. And my father, who was kind enough to bail me out, said, do you think you have the disease? And the still small voice inside me said, pay really close attention. You might get the lawyer paid for. So I said, I don't know. And he said, okay, I've made a deal. You can stay at my mother's house. So I went to my grandmother's house, and he said, I want you to call this guy. And so I called this guy, and he said, meet me at the Howard Johnson's at 7:30 in the morning. Don't have anything to drink. How did he know? And so I go and show up, and this guy starts talking about himself, and talking about himself, and talking about himself. He had problems in his life, in his drinking, and called Alcoholics Anonymous, no more problems, talking about himself, and talking about himself. And I'm just about to come out of my skin. And I realize that this guy is not closing me. And I need a drink really bad. I got to get out of there, so I figure I'll prompt him. I said, do I need treatment? Do I need religion? And he looked at me and he goes, well, Trick. He said, if you can get the $3,000 that treatment costs, go out and drink that money up. And when you're done, call Alcoholics Anonymous. They do it for fun and for free. Well, this kind of got my attention. You know, I mean, I'd never been around anybody who is there to help me that actually said, what is it you do when you get your hands on $3,000? Of course you go out and drink it all up. And then you plan your next move, right? And this guy said to me, it's in the white pages of the phone book. Go look it up and call him. Now, I went home to my grandmother's house. I poured myself a water glass full of Davies County old-fashioned Kentucky bourbon with 3 ice cubes, and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was on the second day of May in 1979. And this man saved my life. This man had at one time had 15 years of sobriety. And at another time, he'd had 10 years of sobriety. He didn't say that to me. I didn't know. And he wasn't an AA member when he met me that morning. And he wasn't an AA member until the day he died. But yet he saved my life. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the message. It's not the messenger. We know each other far too well here. We know each other far too well here. And we don't shoot our wounded. And how many people has that man touched through me? I think there should be a whole category for the people that saved our lives that died drunk. Or that just didn't die wrapped up in this wonderful, wonderful way of life that we've found in Alcoholics Anonymous. Anyway, so I went down to the old Manhattan Beach Club. I called Alcoholics Anonymous, and I ended up in a noon meeting. And when I walked into this noon meeting, everybody started talking at me. And I couldn't understand why they were talking at me. But see, when I'm drinking and my hair is long, I kind of look like the Sphinx. And my fingernails were really long. And I grow a really, like, there are guys who can grow good beards, not me. When I grow a beard, there are big patches that don't fill in. And I hadn't really had enough to drink, so I was starting to do the zup-zups, you know. In fact, my friend Eric, who was at my first meeting, said I looked like I was doing all the 12 Olympic field events while sitting in a chair. So I'm in this meeting, and they're talking at me. And the third guy that talked at me was a guy by the name of Butcher Joe. Now, you can always tell Butcher Joe because he's missing a finger. And Joe talked about when the family left, how he was crying the big crocodile tears. And inside he's going, yes! Now we can drink and there isn't anybody to get in our way. I understood that. And he talked about being at work and knowing just how deeply to cut himself so that they couldn't put a little butterfly bandage on it. And he'd have to go to the hospital. And on the way, he could get the drink that he needed. And I understood that. I understood that. Because, see, I'm a geek. I'm not talking about somebody who's smart with computers. I'm talking about that I will eat a beer glass in a bar in order to win the money on a bet that I need so I can keep drinking. And I haven't had to mutilate myself in order to get the money to drink since I came to you. And this man looked right at me and he told me, you never have to feel the way that you feel about yourself ever again. Yeah, right. Right. If you'll do the things that I've done. What were they? What were they? And this miracle happened. Men and women went around the room and they talked because there was an obvious sick alcoholic in the room, and they talked about how their lives were not that way anymore. And at the end of that meeting, another miracle happened. A few hip guys that were there that were going down to the beach to play cards, they took along the new guy and they started to explain Alcoholics Anonymous to me. This is AA, kid. We don't do no drugs here. I was horrified. I don't know if I would have come to the meeting. But I'd gotten the fact, I'd bought the package that I was alcoholic. And in that first meeting, I heard about the chronic fatal malady and that the first drink is the one that gets you. And that if I'm alcoholic, what I have to do is I have to stay away from the first drink. And that if I smoke that non-habit-forming marijuana, sooner or later I'm going to need to cut the cotton mouth, right? And you guys all know how you do that. You have a couple of beers, right? But that's not drinking. That's just cutting cotton. They said that was drinking. And if you're doing that Peruvian marching powder, you know, you need a double Bombay on the rocks with a twist just to take the edge off, right? That's taking the edge off. It's not drink. They said that was drinking. And if you're getting spiritual, right, and you drop a little LSD, you know, you need about a gallon of wine just to settle through the experience, right? They said that was drinking. Who knew? And they said to me, that the drink bone is connected to the drug bone. And that if I be alcoholic, I have to stay away from alcohol in any form whatsoever. Which brings us to a point. In the doctor's opinion, Dr. Silkworth talks about the non-alcoholic beer. You know why they call it non-alcoholic beer, don't you? It's not for alcoholics. It's got alcohol in it. It's only a little, but it's enough. It's enough to set off this phenomenon of craving, this physical allergy. Do you ever know anybody in the program that started drinking that stuff and soon they're doing a six-pack of it? My brother-in-law, Douglas, drank cases of it a day because he wasn't drinking and he died of cirrhosis of the liver. And I've seen time and time again where I've gone to these funerals and the family looks at you and they go, I thought they were okay. They were with you. And you tell them, well, yeah, they were with us. But they didn't do the things that we do. Which is that we don't use, as Silkworth says, alcohol in any form whatsoever. Because it's the first drink. It's not the last drink. And so, you know, I went off on the thing. I started running around to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I almost drank my third day. It was a Friday night. And I came back to the Alano Club, and I asked a guy, I said, talk program to me, please. And he got me a copy of the big book. I'd been too busy to get one. I didn't want to look like an obvious rookie. Nobody'd shoved it in my hand. You know, I didn't want to look like I was on my way to Bible study. And he told me, just start reading. And so I started reading the book. And as I read it, I got hooked. And I got hooked in the doctor's opinion, where Silkworth talks about the sense of ease and comfort that comes from having a few drinks. Now, that's not what I'd call it. I'd call it, remember when the third one stays down? and you can light your own cigarette? How did they know? And I kept reading. And I was not interested in Bill's story. I wasn't interested in World War I or the stock market crash. I wanted something contemporary. I wanted something disco. Do you know how awful it was getting sober wearing that gear? It was horrible. There were meetings on the west side of Los Angeles where you needed 3 gold chains just to get in the door. Anyway, I kept reading, and I completely missed that the entire program of Alcoholics Anonymous is between page 11 and 13. I missed it. But I kept reading because I wasn't sleeping in those days. The people at the meeting were telling me nobody ever died of lack of sleep trick. And I got into We Agnostics. And at the end of We Agnostics, there's the story of the preacher's son. And it says there, "Who are you to say there is no God?" And I rarely said that there was no God, but I lived as if there was not. And what I did is I did what that guy did. I got down on my knees and I said my prayer. And my prayer was my prayer. And I said, "I don't know from Jesus or Buddha. I don't know from the Torah, the Talmud, the Upanishads. Just please get me the top." I said, "I'll do anything that these dried up old geeks say to do. Just please help me not to drink." And I believe at that moment I finished the first 3 steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The next day I went to the noon meeting. I was there early. There was a woman there. She had a black dress on, a bun in her hair. She looked like she'd been to Mass 8 million times. She said, "Oh, young man, you're new, aren't you?" You know, as I shook there on the couch, "How can you tell?" She said, "I can tell you the secret of Alcoholics Anonymous in 4 words. Really, what are they? Find God or die." No, not that, not that. But we're in Alcoholics Anonymous. I can tell you the secret in 4 words. Find God or die. But remember, when I say God, I'm not saying what you think I'm saying. When I say God, I'm talking about a power that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you stuck a gun in my belly and you said, "Tell me about God, make it good," I'd tell you what Silkwar says in The Doctor's Opinion, that these men and women believe in each other, but they believe even more in the power that brings chronic alcoholics back from the gates of insanity and death. And that's the power that I found. That's the power that I found. And what it is that we have here is we have a set of spiritual exercises which will produce a relationship with a power that will solve your problem. The difficulty is that you have to do them. You can't just agree with them. And everybody wants to agree with AA, but very few people want to do it. But fortunately for me, I had the grace to see that I had alcoholism, a chronic fatal malady. So at that meeting, I got a sponsor. I did my first inventory when I was 24 days sober. Was it a fearless and thorough moral inventory using all 4 columns? No! It's the greatest hits. You know? I did it. My sponsor came over. We read the prayers. And at 25 days sober, I'm off making amends. One of the first amends I made was to my grandmother, Alice. I owed her just a little bit of money. She taught me how to tend bar. And I came to her and I said, "Grandmother, I'm sober. And I owe you money. Bring the money when you're making the amends. And here's some money. And God and AA are helping me to stay sober." She said, "What?" I said, "God and AA are helping me to stay sober." And she got up and she started moving towards the door. I said, "Where are you going?" She said, "Well, kid, about 4 years ago, you told me that you didn't believe in God anymore. So I went down and I put your name on a list at the church. And me and the girls have been praying for you. And I need to go down and report to them that my grandson has been restored." Spiritual terrorism. It works really well. Now, I know in AA nowadays, we are not a bunch of church-going folk particularly, although some of us do align ourselves. But here, I'll give you spiritual terrorism 101. When you walk into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, because you guys all know somebody who's really awful, somebody who needs help. When you walk into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and you see an empty chair, walk up and tap it and say the person's name. Get your friends to do it. Don't stop and see what happens. In 1985, when my then wife Jacqueline got sober, we picked three people. Her best childhood friend, our friend Jeannie, who was a cocktail waitress at the saloon we worked at, and my sister Regina, who was missing in action with her Colombian entrepreneur boyfriend. Within a year and a half, all three of them got sober. All three of them picked up a one-year cake. The two that got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous are still sober to this day. And the other woman, after a year, decided she'd really had enough of this. And she decided to drink. She thought she was making too much of it. Now, here's a little sidebar opinion for you. You know how you sit in a meeting and somebody comes in and, did you hear about Marvin? Marvin drank with 37 years of sobriety. Be afraid. Marvin had not been to a meeting since 1982. He resigned. Alcoholics Anonymous works fine, but you have to be in it. You have to be doing it. You have to be involved. You have to be engaged. It is a way of life. It's my life. It's my life. And what's the life that I've been given here? I've been given the fourth dimension of existence. And when Bill Wilson talks about it, it is not some flowery phrase in the big book. It is a reality. Common sense becomes uncommon sense. And we are charged to live in a way that's just different than most folks. And this spiritual theory, life is not a theory. We got to live it, or at least I do. Because I have a very deep thirst. I've been allergic for a long, long time to reality. And I need a lot of help to get through it. Now, I'm one of these people that AA is my life. I mean, I was living in my car when I came to AA. And it was very clear to me that I was the reason that I was sitting in the meeting. And what I did was I bet my life that AA knew the way out. And I bought the whole package. I haven't done like I did with everything else in my life, where I, you know, took little bits and pieces and went off on my merry way. And what's happened for me is this wonderful, wonderful existence. I come from a long line of violence in the family, and yet I never hit my daughter. Amazing. It stopped with me. I raged at her when she was small, but I was even able to stop that after a time. And my daughter's not afraid of me, which is a wonderful thing because I was always in fear of my parents. That stopped with me. So a message that I have is that isn't necessary. There isn't violence in my home either. Occasional bite here and there, but no big deal. It's all in love. So why am I still involved in this thing? I mean, you know, 27 years. Wouldn't I have gotten a life by now? I mean, really, are you that shallow? But see, I've been seduced by the Spirit. There is nothing that's more interesting to me than Alcoholics Anonymous. It's fascinating. It's fascinating. Why do I go to meetings? Well, I go to meetings because God, as I understand, God's occupied. He's busy.
He needs to know where I am. And Monday night, he knows that if he needs to shoot me a drunk, I'm at the Hermosa Beach Men's Stag. And Tuesday, I have a men's meditation group at my house. And Wednesday, I'm usually up at the Roxbury group, or I'm down at the Salvation Army with my home group. And Thursday night, I'm at the 11th step meeting. And Friday night, I'm at our 12th suggestion meeting. And Saturday and Sunday, many times, I get to stay home if I'm not involved in this work. There was a time in our lives together, and Adele and mine, where she, you know, I was more just kind of an observer, interested. She had a debilitating stroke, and she wasn't able to speak very well, and she was unable to walk, and she was in this hospital, and they didn't know what was wrong with her. They didn't know that it was a stroke. All we knew that she was in chronic pain in her head. We didn't know that the tumor in her heart had broken off a little piece, and they'd been shooting up into her brain. And they were taking a look at her brain, and they were going, "Nah, we can't figure out what it is." But every time the narcotics wore off, she started to be writhing in pain. It looked like something out of a torture chamber. So every 6 hours, they're just hitting her. And she's been in the hospital for a couple weeks. Now, I got a daughter. I'm newly separated. I just started this business. I'm one of these people, one of these men that, you know, I looked in my life and tried to find out, you know, where I was happiness so I could follow my bliss in business. And for me, it was when I was happiest when I was selling stimulants to college students. So I started a coffee bar, and I was back selling stimulants. And so I'd started this business, and I got this young daughter that I'm trying. I'm separated from her mother, and I'm trying to. I got Adele here, and I'm just coming unglued. But it's Thursday night. And see, I'm an AA member that I don't choose whether I'm going to go to my meeting or not. And it's Thursday night, so I go to the 11 step group because I know that God knows that that's where I am. And I go there, and there was a woman that was taking a cake who was sick that night. She was feeling too ill to come, but it was her meeting, and she went to take her birthday cake. And she asked me how Adele was, and I told her. She said, "That doesn't sound right." And she gave me the name of a woman. And we called that person up, and she said, "Yeah, let's get her at that hospital. Let's get her down to UCLA." And so, you know, I started in this, and we got her out of UCLA, and we are out of this other hospital, and we got her down to the UCLA Medical Center. I didn't follow all the rules. It's one of my problems. And I took her instead of having her go in an ambulance. And when we got her to the hospital, they said, "Oh, no, no, we can't admit her. It's obviously an insurance dump, and the medication's wearing off, and she's starting to get in this horrible, writhing pain, and I don't know what to do." And so I do what you taught me to do. I went around the corner. I said, "I need some help. Please, please help me." And because it was my idea to get her there. And I made this phone call back to this woman, and she got the head of the department to come down at the hospital, to leave his post and come down into the admitting area. And fortunately, we had the brain scans with us. And he looked at him, and he said, "Oh, this woman doesn't have headaches. These aren't migraines. She's had a stroke. Admit her immediately." And so they admitted her, and they started doing tests, and they found the tumor in her heart. And a couple days later, they cracked her open like a turkey, and they pulled the tumor out of her heart. You know, and aside from the marriage that she's locked into, she's got a really pretty good life. But if I hadn't have gone to my meeting, how would God have put me in touch with the woman that solved her problem? See, I don't know what's going on. All I know is that there's a lot more going on here than I have any idea. My stepmother, my father and stepmother's alcoholism had gotten horrible. And they went off and they were living up on a ranch in the northern part of the state. And I started... When I found out that my stepmother had cirrhosis of the liver, I started driving up there every couple weeks. It was not what I wanted to do. But it's what I was taught in Alcoholics Anonymous to do, is that right action
is the only thing that matters. Doesn't matter how I feel about it, just go do it. And I was there for my stepmother's death, and then when my father got sick a while later, I was able to be there with him. And he died on my 25th anniversary of coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, the second day of May in 2004. What's that about? What's that about? But since that day, I've been completely unhinged. I mean, it was bad enough when Adele got better from the strokes and stuff, but now I'm completely unhinged because I know that, at least in my life, in my story, it's not about what it is that I think. Now, everybody here knows that the reason that you don't want to do a third step is that you don't want to turn your will and life over to God, because you don't want to end up being a missionary in a third world country, right? Because that's not cool. We all know what cool is. We know what cool is so well that we're lying in a gutter covered in snow, right? And slush, and we're drinking, and we go, I'll do anything except turn my life over to God, because I might end up like in a warm place. In dry clothes, you know, picketing liquor stores and singing AA hymns. But when I was 20 years sober, I went off and I go on retreats. Being part of retreats has been a big part of my sobriety because I don't know anything, everything, and I need to learn about this stuff. I need to learn more and more about the spiritual life. And my first sponsor told me, you always have a spiritual book going. Always have a spiritual book going. Now, the big book is my spiritual book. But the 12 and 12 and all the other conference-approved literature and you know, and then you got to read other stuff. Like, you know, there's a wonderful book called The Feminine Face of God that's wonderful for people that are allergic to a masculine image of God. It's great stuff. And there are all these wonderful, wonderful books. There's a great book called The Screwtape Letters by C.S. Lewis that talks about, you know, about how to corrupt the human soul. It's marvelous. I highly recommend it. It's my favorite book on sponsorship because it's an old demon teaching a young demon how to get the patient. And they call God the enemy in that book. And I kind of like that because it's instead of telling me, you ought to do this, it instructs me from the other side, and I enjoy that. Anyway, so I'm off on this retreat. I'm going to be 20 years sober. I deserve to give myself some time, so I go off on a silent, directed retreat. And while I'm on this retreat, I say a third-step prayer with this guy, you know, and I get quiet, and I said, you know, big guy, whatever you want, I'm up for it. I'm up for it. Be careful about the whatever you want part. You end up in Reykjavik. So I make the mistake. I go to this church, and I hang out, and I believe that it's really important that we approach the spiritual life the same way that we drank and used, which is try a bunch of stuff. You know? Just try it all. You know? It's wonderful. And so anyway, I'm at this church, and I'm sitting there, and this guy gets up, and he says, I'm going down to Belize. I met a man there that I like, and I'm going to, they got donated some land, and I'm going to go and build a church down there. And I listen to this, and I go, oh, that's nice. It's nice for him. It's nice for them. You know, it'll be a nice experience for other people. But, you know, I'm a busy guy, and, you know, I've really got stuff to do, and I don't have the time, and I don't have the money. And the little voice inside of me said, you know, you said that prayer a few weeks ago. Why don't you just stand up for drill? So I stood up and said, okay, I'm going to go. So I come home from church to my nice Jewish wife. And I say, I'm going to go down to Central America and build a house for Jesus. But I don't have the time and I don't have the money. And she looks at me and she goes, sweetheart, that's why you have your own business. If you can't afford to go, The business isn't worthwhile being there. And she said, ask your friends to send you. They'll do it for entertainment value. And so I did. I put up the jar at the coffee house, and I started banging on people, and they're going. And they all start praying for me. Don't let him touch any power tools. Because you can tell I'm real handy. We have a thing at our home where my wife doesn't cook and I don't fix cars. It works really, really well. Anyway, so I go off and I go down there and I'm with all these nice people. Now, I am an alcoholic. I'm a sober guy. I have traditions, concepts, and steps to help me transcend any situation. But I'm down there with these really nice people for about 4 days, and they're really starting to irritate me. So I think I'll go find a meeting, because whenever I travel, I always go to meetings, because I actually believe that my alcoholism travels with me wherever I go. You ever meet people that, oh, yeah, I went over here, and I didn't go to any meetings. I beat my wife and my kids, but we had a wonderful time. Didn't go to any meetings, though. Anyway, so I'm down there, and I walk up to this Guatemalan priest. And we're there in the middle of the jungle in Central America. I'm working with refugees. And I say, Yo busco Alcoholics Anonymous. And he starts to cry. And he says, Yo soy. He says, I'm Alcoholics Anonymous. And there in the middle of the jungle, this man told me his story. And I told him mine. Any time that I have put myself in the position to be of service to God as I understand God, I always get you. I always get Alcoholics Anonymous. I wonder what it is that God's will is for me. I wonder. I was taught that if you put Alcoholics Anonymous first, everything will be first class. Does that mean that I haven't had problems? Oh, yeah, I've had problems. In fact, I think that any problem a man can have, I have had sober. But I've always had a sponsor. I've always been involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've always sponsored. And what I have is I have the love of my life. I wish for you what I've found in Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I've found in Alcoholics Anonymous is a love that transcends words. I have friends all over this planet that come and join me on all kinds of strange enterprises. It's a wonderful way to live, but you have to live it. You can't just agree with it. My life fundamentally changed at 14 years sober with the end of my first marriage. That was like the collapse of my, you know, I wanted so much for that marriage to work, and it didn't. And it wasn't for lack of trying. But then what happened is I got to recreate my life again. And I sat down and I did an inventory. A different kind of sexual inventory. Instead of writing my ideal to be what it is that I thought that I wanted, I actually had the courage to sit down and write what it is that I wanted. And when I went through and I filtered all the different women that I knew, she was on the top of the list. And when I walked up and I approached her, I didn't walk up trying to be cool. I walked up and approached her as if she was the one woman in the world that I wanted to be with. And tonight I sleep with the woman that I want to be with more than any woman in the world. It's a wonderful thing. Sober. And what we did is that we did not just agree with the 11th step. We started practicing it in our home. And we pray and we meditate together. And it's much more difficult to be spiritually intimate than it is to be physically intimate. But we took the risk. When we started meditating together, she said to me you know, okay, well, what are we going to do? And so we started, and I got to, you know, since I'm sober man, you know, I have almost 15 years of sobriety. She had just about five. So we started, and about 3 days after this, she looked at me and she said, you know, this really isn't getting it for me this way that we're going about doing this. And what I heard was, I don't like the way that you kiss, and I'm never going to sleep with you again. Sober man. So I said, okay, darling, tomorrow you lead it. And so we got up in the morning, and we went along with it. And then when she was done, I gave her a little education on why this really wasn't the way that one did the 11th step. I know that it says in our literature that the most important job in Alcoholics Anonymous is the general service representative. Not true. It's your wife's sponsor, because they take all the heat before you get it. So fortunately, I was able to call Adele and said, you know, we've got a 10th step, and I was able to say, God, I'm really an awful bastard. I'm so sorry, sweetheart. I said, let's just go. Let's do it. And we started. And we have built this spiritual life together, where what has happened over the past couple years is that our marriage has become a spiritual entity of its own. And it's so vibrant to be part of. We have a life together that's a dream. And it's sober. And it's folks coming and reading the book. You know? I don't know what your dream is. I don't know what your dream is. But mine is to be here and to be a part of this thing that we call Alcoholics Anonymous. It's my most fervent prayer that what I've done this afternoon is that I've comforted the afflicted and that I've afflicted the comfortable. I hope that what it is that you do is that you go out from here and you sit down and you have a cup of coffee and you think about what it is that we've talked about this weekend. And you go, you know, how can those guys stay sober thinking these things and living like that? You know? Because that's how I learned about Alcoholics Anonymous. The spiritual life is not a theory. You got to live it. And I mentioned that you should go out and try it all. But there's one caveat. If somebody ever says to you that Alcoholics Anonymous is a lower form of spirituality, look at them and smile. They don't have to know. See, they're not allergic types. I'm an alcoholic. I have a chronic, fatal, progressive illness that has been lifted from me by the application of spiritual principles and the continual transmission of the spiritual experience. The holiest place in the world is the birthing room. The second holiest is being present when somebody you love passes into the next dimension. But the next holiest place is at the kitchen table, turning pages, reading a book, when a man or a woman says, oh, I can do this. I can get what you've got. What we do here, what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous, and the other people don't need to know this, is we literally are the fulfillment of all the spiritual laws, because we clothe the naked and we visit them in the prison and we go to the hospital and we feed the hungry and we raise the dead here. I drank away my soul. I was an animal. And a man took the time to show me a few simple spiritual exercises that when I did it, the breath of life returned to me. And I have the privilege today to try and pass that on to others. And it is a great joy, and it is a wonderful privilege, and it is something that is available to each and every one of you. Don't miss it. There was a man by the name of Aubrey Menn, and he said there are three things that are true. The first is God, and the second is human folly, and the third is laughter. The first two are unfathomable, so we must do what we can with the third. God bless you.